Chapter 65. In which Joes takes flight, and the war's brought to a close, we of peaceful London City have never beheld, and please God never shall witness such a scene of hurry and alarm, as that which Brussels presented. Crowds rushed to the Namur Gate, from which direction the noise proceeded, and many rode along the level chaussee, to be in advance of any intelligence from the army. Each man asked his neighbor for news, and even great English lords and ladies condescended to speak to persons whom they did not know. The friends of the French went abroad, wild with excitement, and prophesying the triumph of their emperor. The merchants closed their shops, and came out to swell the general chorus of alarm and clamor. Women rushed to the churches, and crowded the chapels, and knelt and prayed on the flags and steps. The dull sound of the cannon went on rolling, rolling. Presently carriages with travelers began to leave the town, galloping away by the Ghent barrier. The prophecies of the French partisans began to pass for facts. "He has cut the armies in two," it was said. "He is marching straight on Brussels. He will overpower the English, and be here tonight. He will overpower the English," shrieked Isidore to his master, "and will be here tonight." The man bounded in, and out from the lodgings to the street, always returning with some fresh particulars of disaster. Joe's face grew paler and paler. Alarm began to take entire possession of the stout civilian. All the champagne he drank brought no courage to him. Before sunset he was worked up to such a pitch of nervousness as gratified his friend Isidore to behold, who now counted surely upon the spoils of the owner of the lace coat. The women were away all this time. After hearing the firing for a moment, the stout major's wife bethered her of her friend in the next chamber, and ran in to watch, and if possible to console, Amelia. The idea that she had that helpless and gentle creature to protect gave additional strength to the natural courage of the honest Irishwoman. She passed 5 hours by her friend's side, sometimes in remonstrance, sometimes talking cheerfully, oftener in silence and terrified mental supplication. "Never let go her hand once," said the stout lady afterwards, "until after sunset, when the firing was over. Pauline, the bonne, was on her knees at church hard by, praying for son Amiel." When the noise of the cannonading was over, Mrs. O'Dowd issued out of Amelia's room into the parlor adjoining, where Joe sate with two emptied flasks, and courage entirely gone. Once or twice he had ventured into his sister's bedroom, looking very much alarmed, and as if he would say something. But the major's wife kept her place, and he went away without disburthening himself of his speech. He was ashamed to tell her that he wanted to fly. But when she made her appearance in the dining room, where he sat in the twilight in the cheerless company of his empty champagne bottles, he began to open his mind to her. "Mrs. O'Dowd," he said, "hadn't you better get Amelia ready? Are you going to take her out for a walk?" Said the major's lady, "Sure she's too weak to stir." "I've ordered the carriage," he said, and post horses. "Isidore is gone for them," Joe's continued. "What do you want with driving tonight?" answered the lady. "S'n'T she better on her bed? I've just got her to lie down." "Get her up," said Joe's. "She must get up, I say." And he stamped his foot energetically. "Say the horses are ordered." "Yes, the horses are ordered." "It's all over, and what?" asked Mrs. O'Dowd. "I'm off for Ghent," Joe's answered. "Verybody is going. There's a place for you. We shall start in half an hour." The major's wife looked at him with infinite scorn. "Don't move till O'Dowd gives me the route," said she. "Why, you may go if you like, Mr. Sedley, but, faith, Amelia and I stop here." "She shall go," said Joe's, with another stamp of his foot. Mrs. O'Dowd put herself with arms akimbo before the bedroom door. "Is it her mother you're going to take her to?" she said. "Or do you want to go to Mama yourself, Mr. Sedley? Good morning, a pleasant journey to ye, sir. Bon voyage, as they say, and take my counsel, and shave off the mustachios, or they'll bring you into mischief. The end. Yelled out Joes, wild with fear, rage, and mortification, and Isidore came in at this juncture, swearing in his turn. As the Chevaux, Sasser blew, hissed out the furious domestic. All the horses were gone. Joes was not the only man in Brussels seized with panic that day. But Joe's fears, great and cruel as they were already, were destined to increase to an almost frantic pitch before the night was over. It has been mentioned how Pauline, the Bonne, had son Amael also in the ranks of the army that had gone out to meet the Emperor Napoleon. This lover was a native of Brussels, and a Belgian hussar. The troops of his nation signalized themselves in this war for anything but courage, and young Van Cutsem, Pauline's admirer, was too good a soldier to disobey his colonel's orders to run away. Whilst in garrison at Brussels, young Regulus, he had been born in the revolutionary times, found his great comfort, and passed almost all his leisure moments in Pauline's kitchen, and it was with pockets and holsters crammed full of good things from her larder that he had take leave of his weeping sweetheart, to proceed upon the campaign a few days before. As far as his regiment was concerned, this campaign was over now. They had formed a part of the division under the command of his sovereign apparent, the Prince of Orange, and as respected length of swords and mustachios, and the richness of uniform and equipments, Regulus and his comrades looked to be as gallant a body of men as ever trumpet sounded for. When they dashed upon the advance of the Allied troops, carrying one position after the other, until the arrival of the great body of the British army from Brussels, changed the aspect of the combat of Quatre Bras, the squadrons among which Regulus rode showed the greatest activity in retreating before the French, and were dislodged from one post, and another which they occupied with perfect alacrity on their part. Their movements were only checked by the advance of the British in their rear. Thus forced to halt, the enemy's cavalry, whose bloodthirsty obstinacy cannot be too severely reprehended, had at length an opportunity of coming to close quarters with the brave Belgians before them, who preferred to encounter the British rather than the French, and at once turning tail rode through the English regiments that were behind them and scattered in all directions. The regiment, in fact, did not exist anymore. It was nowhere. It had no headquarters. Regulus found himself galloping many miles from the field of action, entirely alone, and whither should he fly for refuge so naturally as to that kitchen and those faithful arms in which Pauline had so often welcomed him? At some 10 o'clock, the clinking of a saber might have been heard up the stair of the house, where the Osbornes occupied a story in the continental fashion. A knock might have been heard at the kitchen door, and poor Pauline, come back from church, fainted almost with terror as she opened it, and saw before her her haggard hussar. He looked as pale as the midnight dragoon who came to disturb Leonora. Pauline would have screamed, but that her cry would have called her masters, and discovered her friend. She stifled her scream then, and leading her hero into the kitchen, gave him beer, and the choice bits from the dinner, which Joes had not had the heart to taste. The hussar showed he was no ghost by the prodigious quantity of flesh and beer which he devoured, and during the mouthfuls he told his tale of disaster. His regiment had performed prodigies of courage, and had withstood for a while the onset of the whole French army. But they were overwhelmed at last, as was the whole British army by this time. They destroyed each regiment as it came up. The Belgians in vain interposed to prevent the butchery of the English. The Brunswickers were routed, and had fled. Their Duke was killed. It was a general debacle. He sought to drown his sorrow for the defeat in floods of beer. Isidore, who had come into the kitchen, heard the conversation and rushed out to inform his master. "Tea is all over," he shrieked to Joes. "Eiler Duke is a prisoner. The Duke of Brunswick is killed. The British army is in full flight. There is only one man escaped, and he is in the kitchen now. Come and hear him." So Joe's toddled into that apartment, where Regula still sat on the kitchen table, and clung fast to his flagon of beer, in the best French which he could muster, and which was in sooth of a very ungrammatical sort. Joe's besought the hussar to tell his tale. The disasters deepened as Regula spoke. He was the only man of his regiment not slain on the field. He had seen the Duke of Brunswick fall, the black hussars fly, the Écossais pounded down by the cannon. And the TH? Gasped Joes. Cut in pieces, said the hussar, upon which Pauline cried out, "Oh, my mistress, ma bonne petite dame," went off fairly into hysterics, and filled the house with her screams. Wild with terror, Mr. Sedley knew not how or where to seek for safety. He rushed from the kitchen back to the sitting room, and cast an appealing look at Amelia's door, which Mrs. O'Dowd had closed and locked in his face. But he remembered how scornfully the latter had received him, and after pausing and listening for a brief space at the door, he left it, and resolved to go into the street, for the first time that day. So, seizing a candle, he looked about for his gold-laced cap, and found it lying in its usual place, on the console table, in the anteroom, placed before a mirror at which Joe's used to coquette, always giving his side locks a twirl, and his cap the proper cock over his eye, before he went forth, to make appearance in public. Such is the force of habit, that even in the midst of his terror he began mechanically, to twiddle with his hair, and arrange the cock of his hat. Then he looked amazed at the pale face in the glass before him, and especially at his mustachios, which had attained a rich growth in the course of near 7 weeks, since they had come into the world. "They will mistake me for a military man," thought he, remembering Isidore's warning, as to the massacre with which all the defeated British army was threatened. And staggering back to his bedchamber, he began wildly pulling the bell which summoned his valet. Isidore answered that summons. Joe's had sunk in a chair. He had torn off his neckcloths, and turned down his collars, and was sitting with both his hands lifted to his throat. "Kaupas moi, Isidore," shouted he, "vite! Kaupas moi!" Isidore thought for a moment he had gone mad, and that he wished his valet to cut his throat. "Less mustaches," gasped Joe. "Less mustaches, cooey, racy, vite." His French was of this sort voluble, as we have said, but not remarkable for grammar. Isidore swept off the mustachios in no time with the razor, and heard with inexpressible delight his master's orders, that he should fetch a hat and a plain coat. "E porti plu habit militar bon boni a vous," prenny dears were Joe's words. The coat and cap were at last his property. This gift being made, Joe selected a plain black coat and waistcoat from his stock, and put on a large white neckcloth, and a plain beaver. If he could have got a shovel hat, he would have worn it. As it was, you would have fancied he was a flourishing, large parson of the Church of England. "Veni maintenant," he continued, "suivi li parti dans la rue." And so having said, he plunged swiftly down the stairs of the house, and passed into the street. Although Regulus had vowed that he was the only man of his regiment, or of the allied army, almost, who had escaped being cut to pieces by Ney, it appeared that his statement was incorrect, and that a good number more of the supposed victims had survived the massacre. Many scores of Regulus's comrades had found their way back to Brussels, and all agreeing that they had run away filled the whole town with an idea of the defeat of the Allies. The arrival of the French was expected hourly. The panic continued, and preparations for flight went on everywhere. "No horses," thought Joes, in terror. He made Isidore inquire of scores of persons, whether they had any to lend or sell, and his heart sank within him, at the negative answers returned everywhere. Should he take the journey on foot? Even fear could not render that ponderous body so active. Almost all the hotels occupied by the English in Brussels face the park, and Joe's wandered irresolutely about in this quarter, with crowds of other people, oppressed as he was by fear and curiosity. Some families he saw more happy than himself, Having discovered a team of horses, and rattling through the streets in retreat, others again there were whose case was like his own, and who could not for any bribes or entreaties procure the necessary means of flight. Amongst these would be fugitives. Joes remarked the Lady Barrisers and her daughter, who sate in their carriage in the porte-cochere of their hotel, all their imperials packed, and the only drawback to whose flight was the same want of motive power which kept Joes stationary. Rebecca Crawley occupied apartments in this hotel, and had before this period had sundry hostile meetings with the ladies of the Barrisers family. My Lady Barrisers cut Mrs. Crawley on the stairs, when they met by chance, and in all places, where the latter's name was mentioned, spoke perseveringly ill of her neighbor. The Countess was shocked at the familiarity of General Tufto with the aide-de-camp's wife. The Lady Blanche avoided her, as if as he had been an infectious disease. Only the Earl himself kept up a sly occasional acquaintance with her, when out of the jurisdiction of his ladies. Rebecca had her revenge now upon these insolent enemies. It became known in the hotel that Captain Crawley's horses had been left behind, and when the panic began, Lady Barrisers condescended to send her maid to the captain's wife with her ladyship's compliments, and a desire to know the price of Mrs. Crawley's horses. Mrs. Crawley returned a note with her compliments, and an intimation that it was not her custom to transact bargains with ladies' maids. This curt reply brought the Earl in person to Becky's apartment, but he could get no more success than the first ambassador. "And the lady's maid to me?" Mrs. Crawley cried in great anger. "Why didn't my Lady Barrisers tell me to go and saddle the horses? Is it her ladyship that wants to escape, or her ladyship's femme de chambre?" And this was all the answer that the Earl bore back to his Countess. What will not necessity do? The Countess herself actually came to wait upon Mrs. Crawley on the failure of her second envoy. She entreated her to name her own price. She even offered to invite Becky to Barrister's house, if the latter would but give her the means of returning to that residence. Mrs. Crawley sneered at her. "I don't want to be waited on by bailiffs in livery," she said. "You will never get back, though most probably at least not you and your diamonds together. The French will have those, they will be here in 2 hours, and I shall be halfway to Ghent by that time. I would not sell you my horses, no, not for the two largest diamonds that your ladyship wore at the ball." Lady Barrisers trembled with rage and terror. "The diamonds were sewed into her habit, and secreted in my lord's padding and boots. W woman, the diamonds are at the banker's, and I will have the horses," she said. Rebecca laughed in her face. The infuriate Countess went below, and sat in her carriage. Her maid, her courier, and her husband were sent once more through the town, each to look for cattle, and woe betide those who came last. Her ladyship was resolved on departing the very instant the horses arrived from any quarter with her husband or without him. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.